Monster Professor.
Welcome to The Monster Professor, a show in which we discuss and explore monsters in literature, myth, film, games, folklore, culture, and beyond. I'm your host, Josh Woods, author, editor, professor, and monster expert. And first, a few short housekeeping notes. I'd like to welcome the many new listeners. It was really cool to see hundreds of new listeners coming in on all sorts of different platforms on which The Monster Professor airs. It mostly due to the various awesome guests who have been generous enough to talk with me on the show, sharing the episodes with their friends or people who keep up with what they do. So if you're new to the Monster Professor, welcome very much. Another housekeeping note, whether you're new or you've been with me for a while, don't forget, if you haven't already, drop a rating or a comment on whatever platform you listen to the show on to let other people know what you think about it. If you like it, say why you like it or that you do. If you absolutely hate it but you listen anyway, then maybe explain yourself about why you would do that, but also let them know the truth. And what platforms is it on? Well, you could be listening to this on iTunes, Spotify, YouTube, iHeartRadio, Stitcher, Google Play, you name it. Also on my own website, joshwoodsauthor.com. That's where it originally feeds to the others, but you can find more info about me or about the show or about my own books, all of that. You can also contact me if you have comments, not for everyone else, but for me, or questions or requests, ideas for guests, you name it, shoot them my way. About this upcoming episode, that I get to talk with Deputy Sheriff Lieutenant Kermit Moore. And in addition to that persona, he has existed in fictional versions in at least three different versions or three different publications that I can name. He's a real-life crime fighter and doughty opponent of evil. And in this conversation, we discuss the confrontation with true evil and how to deal with it. We also dig into the nature of intuition, of premonition, of consciousness, and a whole bunch of other things in between, all the way down to very pragmatic levels like ballistics for shooting monsters. And so I really enjoyed this conversation, but something weird came up at the beginning of it. We're gonna start the episode by talking about it. The episodes in which I discuss with a guest true evil, something weird has happened that it was trying to interrupt the actual conversation or podcast. I discounted the first couple to my own inexperience or incompetence. This one happened the very minute we were supposed to start, and even the provider was baffled at how and why it was such a widespread outage. I don't know. I guess judge for yourself. Either way, I hope you enjoy this conversation as much as I did with Kermit Moore. If he's in, I'm in. So I was just going to start the recording mid-conversation, and I think our first topic should be this, if you're okay with that.
Yeah, let's talk about whatever you want to talk about. But yeah, this is particularly relevant, I think.
I think so too. Okay, so for everybody listening right now, what has just happened is for the first time ever, my internet goes out mid-conversation in the podcast, and the internet service provider, it's a surprise to them. They don't know what's going on. And then when they got it back up, it went out again. And I, on the phone, I talked to the internet service provider, customer service tech lady, and I asked her, since I was actually in the middle of a podcast about fighting true evil, do you think any black magic or true evil had anything to do with it? And she goes, well, if it is, it's strong black magic, because I don't know what's going on. And I said, that's not a denial. She goes, I'm not denying it. So could you say again what you just said about the immune system? Because I love that.
Well, Well, you know how our body tends to fight off things, and it could be it's not even an automatic. I mean, I'm sorry, it's an automatic response. We don't have to think that our body needs to do it; it just kind of does it when it has an invader.
Yeah.
And whether if there's some kind of energy, it could be conscious or unconscious out there, and there's something a threat to it. Perhaps it's responding to it and trying to block your work. I mean, and you know, I thought this for a while, and especially after hearing one of your other podcasts recently, you're kind of like the Joe Rogan of the supernatural. you know, this brilliant guy who is very multifaceted. You know, you train in a lot of different physical things. You're a fantastic writer. You just have a fantastic mind, and you know, when you start focusing on something like the thing, like what you're passionate about, you know, you're passionate about your writing. You're passionate about monsters. You're passionate about this, not called the supernormal, you know, and you don't do it in a tongue-in-cheek way. I mean, you're very serious. You're very fun about it, but you're also very serious about it. And some things, I'll use people as an analogy. Some people don't like the light to shine on them when they're trying to operate in the darkness. And there is an entertaining aspect of what you do, but it's also a very practical and real aspect of what you do. That it's possible that something, or maybe someone that listens just doesn't like it.
I don't know. Like I wouldn't really have thought much about it, but it's an odd coincidence. The last three episodes, something bizarre happened on the other end or on my end that has never happened before. Within a year of doing this kind of stuff. So I'm starting to wonder, man, I don't know. And so I like the supernatural version of Joe Rogan. I don't know.
Well, you know, you're both into MMA. You know, you're both very smart, great podcasts, and I think you're just much more well read and literary. And I think you're just an awesome person.
Well, thank you.
So it's a pleasure to be. I've always thought so, and it's a pleasure to be talking.
Well, thank
to you,
you so much, man. It's a huge pleasure and honor to talk with you. And so, if I haven't said it yet, I get to talk with Kermit Moore right now. Now, among other things, am I correct in saying your job title is Deputy Sheriff, County of Roanoke? Is that right?
Yes, well, actually, I'm a lieutenant on one of the shifts, but we're all deputy sheriffs, just a different rank. So right now, I'm one of the shift supervisors.
Okay, so lieutenant. All right. Some of the listeners might know you in some of your, I guess, fictional forms, because anyone who has listened to or has read one of my stories in my newest book, O Monstrous World, it's called In Which Pinckney Benedict, Kermit Moore, and I Go A-Hunting for the Big Muddy Monster, and this is that Kermit Moore that I get to talk with. In addition to that, those who have read or studied any of Pinckney Benedict's fiction might have come across an excellent story of his called Pig Helmet and the Wall of Life. And in many ways, Pig Helmet is inspired by you as well. And then there was a time, it was about a decade ago, in which I was editing an anthology that I'd come up with called The Versus Anthology through Press 53. And I got a submission from someone who was a dead pirate who was named El Pollo Diablo. And he submitted a story in which The whole concept of the anthology was you take two iconic or historical or interesting characters or forces and you just pit them against each other for one story's length. And I got this submission in from El Pollo Diablo called Theodore Roosevelt versus Spring Hill Jack. And interviewings by me, El Pollo Diablo, dead pirate of the netherworld. And Pinckney said he knew who it was, but he wouldn't tell me. And I suspected it was you, but I started not knowing. And I still have never got direct confirmation that El Pollo Diablo was you. but he's published, whoever he is.
whoever he is. Yeah, that was – you know, the funny thing about the El Pollo Diablo character, it really started in – It started as a response to a board that I was reading online. It covered all kinds of paranormal things, everything from UFOs to ghosts and everything. And there was one thread that I came across, and somebody was claiming to be psychic, and they were channeling spirits. People would ask them questions, and they would just give them all this really weird BS stuff back. I was like, wow. And then people were just absolutely buying it. And I'm looking at it, I'm just thinking, charlatan. And so I just started kind of doing the same thing back, but so tongue-in-cheek as to be obvious, you know, that this is – what I was doing was not real, which was basically portraying a dead pirate that would answer questions from the living, you know, and predict the future and stuff like that. And it was not appreciated on those boards, because I can tell you right now, if I had thought somebody was sincere and real, you know, I would never poke fun anything like that was somebody that was really sincere, but it just seemed like there were so many people that were just trying to manipulate other people. I was trying to lightheartedly get people thinking in a different direction. But anyway, that on top of like this way that people could become so false in social media as it was coming about at the time. And that time it was MySpace. It was before Facebook, and people could be anybody. So I just transposed that character over to MySpace and just tried to have fun with it and make it something fun for people just to enjoy. And even there, at least one person got mad at me, because I would always try to lift people's spirits or just do something, you know, funny. And everybody was following along in that spirit. But one person asked me specifically about Ted Bundy. And I think I was probably just in a specific mood that day. Like, what was Ted Bundy doing? I was like, oh, he's burning in hell. Yeah. And they got so mad.
At Ted Bundy?
Not because I didn't pay. Yes. They were not mad because the answer was short, because it was kind of deliberately short, because sometimes it would get kind of long, and I thought brevity might just be kind of entertaining this time. But they were mad because I seemed to be – this person had a serious – infatuation with Ted Bundy, and me insinuating that he was actually burning in hell, just it made her furious. Furious. Come to find out that through other associations, I think she's had like some other issues in the past, you know, with how she deals with reality. But yeah, that was one that caught me way out of left field, that somebody was actually mad that I insinuated Ted Bundy might be in a what passes for hell.
God, that is crazy. I haven't, you know, you'd expect that kind of like the quick offense and those kinds of reactions would come at me even more in this era, in 2019, 2020-ish era. I have received a little bit of hate mail, but not nearly as much as I thought. Of course, you got to listen to, at this point of the recording, the John Michael Greer episode hasn't aired, but by the time people are hearing this, that will have aired. So I might change my tune by then, because that might be the most controversial out of any of the episodes, I think, but except maybe for this one.
Well, I'm curious. Why do you think? I mean, I have heard it. I thought it was a fantastic interview. I loved what he had to say, and I love the questions that you asked him. What do you think it is about that might cause the controversy? Because what you said about somebody thinking that you know, ghosts, when somebody made the comment that, well, ghosts aren't monsters or ghosts are real. It's like, oh, okay, fair enough. And monsters can also be real. But I at least understood that. So I'm trying to figure out what it is you think might trigger people with that.
I'm not really sure, because I can never predict, but something, my best guess would be something to the effect of that he's a true, sincere druid magic worker, that he's unapologetically an occultist, and that he doesn't hold to anything, say, Christian or anything non-pagan. Like, he's a full-on pagan, he's a full-on occultist, he's not playing around at all with it, and he thinks it's a path to true, he thinks it's a true path. And Yeah, and he was so kind of open and inviting and non-aggressive about it that I would think anyone would be wrong to be offended. But you know, that was my guess.
Well, I feel the exact same way with you. I mean, there was nothing. He did seem very open. He wasn't pushing anything on anybody. And I think only truly dogmatic people, no matter what their bent, would be the ones to be offended by somebody that doesn't kind of follow their creed. So, like, if that triggers some callers, or some listeners, I should say, I guess I can see that, but I don't. It's just not very enlightened.
That's true, and I think the truth is that the real complaints are always going to be things I don't predict, like people getting mad at me about the Phoenix or the Beverly Hillbillies or something.
or you know, dead body burning in hell. It's you're right. It's the things you don't see come, and you know, you in some ways you just can't pay too much attention to that because you can't predict it, and you can't censor yourself either. You're just not being true.
Yeah,
true to what you do.
Yeah. And so, well, if at this point people are wondering, like, wait, how do you two even know each other? Well, mostly we know each other just by chatting online and stuff all the time. But we did get to meet at one time. You put me through tactical handgun training because you also have trained SWAT teams. Am I correct in remembering that?
I was our range master, which was lead firearms instructor for several years and firearms instructor for well over a decade and firearms instructor while I was on our emergency response team for about 7 or 8 years. So it was I didn't lead any specialized instruction, like the stuff that we would go to other places, like went to and like two LAPD SWAT courses and just various trainings we would go to throughout the years. But yeah, I was one of the firearms instructors while on that team and one of the instructors through several years of our local academy.
Yeah, and you put me through a day of lessons that totally changed my approach to firearm combat. Now, I'm a decent shot with a rifle. I was a Kentucky state champion way back in the day, which is small bore. But with a handgun, I was completely useless until after that day. You taught me everything I needed to know about sight picture and trigger pull or trigger squeeze and then clearing rooms, which that was a hilarious disaster on my end, but I learned a lot, I think. And then I ended up consulting you a lot on my novel I was working on that ended up being The Black Palace. You were one of the few people I actually wrote the book for. I really wanted to entertain myself and Melissa, my wife, and Pinckney and you. And we know each other at first through our common friend Pinckney. And that was about it. I just hoped that you guys would like it. And you came up with these fantastic ideas for the exotic rounds.
Well, it warms my heart to hear you say that because it was such a fun read and such a pleasure to enjoy. And I actually enjoy multiple times and it's different and it's different incarnations.
Yeah, you were nice enough to read like at least two, maybe three different drafts of the thing, which is quite patient and generous of a friend, I would say. And so I wanted to do something in the book in which I wanted the witch finders to have like viable, legitimate ammunition. Like if you wanted to shoot splinters of white oak into someone's heart, or if you wanted to shoot, say, mirror shards into someone's heart, how could you get it through the barrel, out the muzzle, across the distance and into the target without like losing it beforehand and without it not dissipating? And you came up with a brilliant idea. Do you recall the details of the exotic rounds?
Well, I remember we were trying to find a medium that would keep everything from one place and keep the mass heavy enough to actually penetrate and it wouldn't scatter all over the place. And so just coming out of a shot cup of a shotgun wouldn't do it, and wood would just slow down immediately. It would just not work at all. But yeah, I got the inspiration from the beanbag rounds
oh,
that law
yeah.
enforcement
yeah.
uses, which is basically lead shot in a type of fabric. It's a really heavy fabric, so it doesn't come apart. And trying to come up with some kind of fabric that we could use that would actually come apart on impact, or, you know, or at least come apart enough, but still stay together as it left the shotgun and the shot cup. So what was it? What did we
it
come
was
up with?
It was pantyhose.
Or
it was something?
Something
as common as pantyhose. And sure enough, as far as everything I could find out, that totally worked, man. It would keep that together through the muzzle blast, and then it would hold together until impact, at which it would tear apart and deliver the rounds. And so I ended up in the book, they were like slaying among the Witchfinders Union was calling them hot mamas, because you wrap these things up in pantyhose and shoot them at high velocity.
Oh, and these days there are so many people doing stuff on YouTube, like the ammunition testing. I think these days it would be so much easier. You could just reach out to these guys, say, I think this might work, and they have the skill to actually do the ammo loading themselves, and money and backing. They would probably just film the results for you and say, yep, this worked.
Yeah,
and this
they do
didn't
a lot
work.
Of cool stuff, especially with that high, that air compressed ballistics, the level to which they're doing
yes.
that. That's fantastic yeah. stuff. So the bean bag round that you have, you, mm-hmm. I know sometimes law enforcement people have to get like shot with or hit with some of the non-lethal stuff. Have you ever had to like go through training in which you take any of the non-lethal rounds, like tasers or the beanbag rounds or anything like that?
Tasers, yes. Tasers multiple times.
Multiple
not
times.
Oh
God.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, and policies did different places change. Some people require you to not. Some people say you have to. I think our policy now is you don't have to. Pepper spray, different. You know, it depends on agencies, but in the academy, our recruits get sprayed with this. Have been sprayed with the pepper spray. The bean background. Interesting story about that. The answer to those kind of things are no, because they're considered less lethal, which means it doesn't mean it won't hurt you. It means it can kill you, but there's less of a likelihood
yeah.
of it killing you. So that's why that's what comes to terms less lethal. So it's usually not advised that people, you know, get shot with it. But there, we did do some testing at one point, and one of my friends at work, you know, he put on a lot of what they call red man armor, just like a foam armor they use for defensive yeah. tactics, and they were going to shoot him with it. And I had been dumb enough to volunteer myself to also be in the lineup to get hit with it, and. This was back when beanbags used to be in a square beanbag. Have you ever see the beanbag
yeah,
toss?
Yeah.
Or the cornhole toss. They were square. They used to be square like that. Well, when you have something that's square and flat and it starts to spin when it comes out of the barrel, it takes on the properties of, like, say, a Frisbee. And you can't tell exactly where it's going to go. It may go off to one side or the other, which is absolutely not what you want to do. It makes it dangerous for anybody. It's a long, you know, that is not the target, or you might hit your target in an area you didn't intend to, like a place that could really hurt them. And they fired it, and it kind of flew off to the side and hit him in the arm, just grazed the arm in a part they didn't have any protection on, just out of sheer bad luck. And the skin was actually fused to his shirt.
Oh, my God.
When we pulled the shirt up, the impact and the abrasion was so harsh that the skin was stuck to his shirt when we pulled that up. He actually had to have plastic surgery to take care of that scarring. And so I couldn't get my padding off fast enough. Like, no, this was stupid. I don't even know who thought of it, but, you know, we should do something special to you for just coming up with the idea. And I felt stupid for even volunteering. But you know, beanbags now, they're round and they have kind of a tail on them that provides stabilization. So they're much more accurate now. That would be much less dangerous, but it still can absolutely ruin somebody's day. So it's just one step away from shooting them. You know, it's one of your last options before you actually have to fire live ammunition.
I really hope I don't have to find out what any of those ever feel like.
You know, I suspect unless something goes horribly, horribly wrong in your life or with society, I don't think your type of person is ever going to be on the receiving end of anything like that.
I don't know. Make bad decisions every now and then.
But you never know what kind of this negative energy that's out there that keeps trying to shut you up. You never know how it's going to manifest itself.
You never know.
So, maybe
might possess a cop, like maniac cop. Now you have a lot of other hobbies and projects going on too. Like you were teaching some defense classes or handgun. I forget exactly which for charity. Like if people brought in food, that would be their tuition payment. Is that right?
Yeah. Yeah, that was an idea our sheriff came up with because he really wanted people to have access to good firearms training if they were going to get a concealed carry permit or just own a handgun or have firearms where in homes with families. But he wanted to make sure they had good training, so he was just letting us provide the training, and he also had the idea of let's just charge like cans of food to go to local food banks and charities. And people were so excited to jump on board with that. You know, all the firearms instructors were lining up to do it. And the public was really enthusiastic about it. And you can't beat the cost. We did that. He did the same thing with some hand-to-hand self-defense courses, especially designed for women. But I did those a few times. Primarily I was involved with the handgun classes.
That's so cool. I wish more people would kind of, especially in this area where the prices of those kind of concealed carry classes are so high, I wish more would take that kind of note, that if you're serious about this, the kind of stuff being really beneficial. Pardon me, sorry. Jeez. Yeah, if you're serious about this kind of stuff being really beneficial, maybe through one method or another, a lot of it could go just through charity. And I think that opens the door to a lot of good things, I think.
Yeah, it was a really good model. Of course, some people make their living off of providing that kind of education, and we don't want to rob their livelihood. That certainly wasn't the goal, and then those places are still making plenty of money. But it's definitely a good opportunity to have for some people that just you can't afford some of those classes. And I know out in Illinois where Pinckney is, the class length, required class length is very onerous, and so it would be hard to donate time. I guess No, absolutely. I guess a department could donate that much time. Yeah, sure they could.
And among your other projects too, you would go with your camera around to abandoned places, like abandoned buildings or old abandoned farmsteads, and take some of the most beautiful and haunting photographs I might have ever seen. In fact, one of your photographs is my desktop at work for anybody who's been in my office. And I've seen, among other things, the Ouija board and the tarot cards on the wall and the giant velvet painting of Hulk Hogan. from Hulkamania, the 80s, and then they would see a Kermit Moore photograph on my desktop. Now, how in the world did you get into this?
It's very flattering.
Mixing photography and the Gothic so much.
I've always been fascinated with things that are kind of, they're scary, but also haunting. I don't know that it's necessarily with some of the old places, whether it's the idea that there's something there, but mostly it's about there's something was there, whether something, people were there. And I would just wonder what was going on when they were living. And it seems so much more haunting, not in a supernatural sense, to see the old decayed places and let your imagination run wild with what life was there like, much more so than just driving by an occupied house and just thinking, I wonder what's going on in there today. So anyway, that just kind of captured my imagination. I started taking a few pictures here and there, and I also was thinking about different stories that could go with each place. And then finally, I just dropped the whole story idea and just became fascinated with the places themselves. And it soon became not so much about taking the photos as about just seeing the place and feeling what it was about. And I think that's probably when I was able to do that, that was probably some of my more successful photographs, because I wasn't trying for anything to do anything but just capture how the place felt.
Yeah.
And
did you ever feel like any of those places like felt different, like the spirit of the place and what must have gone on there was significantly different in one spot than another spot that wasn't necessarily explained by, you know, what was left behind?
Only one. And that was at, and I've been in some very, very decayed and creepy places, and I've never been frightened out of my, which I expected to be. I expected to get like some bad feelings or bad vibes. Just think, I feel uncomfortable here. I'm not going to hang around. But that was never the case. But one place, it was in a old convalescent home in West Virginia. And it had been abandoned since the 80s, and it was this huge red brick building with white columns. And every time I've been there, even before I was taking pictures, I would stop by there every once in a while and just walk around. There were parts that you would get to, and you just felt like, you know, it just felt a little like you weren't alone, and not exactly welcome. I can't describe it more than that. But I was up on a long porch area. And I was taking pictures in one direction, and then I was standing in front of a window, and then the hair on the back of my neck just stood up, and I just felt like there was somebody right behind me. And I stepped kind of away from the window because I didn't really want to turn around, because even though there's that I'm probably not going to see anything, I didn't want to take the chance of seeing anything. But I stepped to the side and then turned around and kind of looked in the window, and I didn't see a thing except the light coming through the other window, bouncing off like the red brick on the other side and casting this beautiful light on the floor. And that was a picture that I loved taking. And I felt like after that, that was just something was tapping me on the shoulder saying, look over here. But as far as bad feelings, like not in any places that I went to photograph. Where I work has been slightly different though. There are places at our courthouse that nobody's really a fan of.
Yeah, that's where I was hoping we could go, and I wasn't sure how comfortable you'd be talking about this, you know, spiritually, emotionally, or even legally. But I was curious about your encounters out there doing your job with, you know, where you have to get called. I mean, a lot of what you do is just helping real people through real problems, everyday problems. But every now and then you have to deal with situations and people that get really dark and really bad. And I'm still haunted by your description of this madman. I don't know I know the madman is not the politically correct term for someone who's suffering from mental illness, but this, the description of this seemed to go beyond like a mental illness into something rather demonic. And I'm still haunted by this. And so I'm curious about whether you can discuss any encounters with something that you might have conceived of as being true evil.
Well, and sure. I mean, if there's somebody still living, I probably won't use their name, and some of those names I probably can't remember anyway. But you know, the thing about evil is it's already there. I'm trying to think how to dive into that. I mean, human beings are capable of the best things we can imagine and also the worst things that we can imagine. In a spiritual sense, true evil, I don't know about the feeling of otherness as opposed to the feeling of malevolence. When I think of evil, even with people, I think evil, to me, evil is cruelty that is done for the sake of just enjoying the cruelty. And I don't believe that there is any fictional or real monster or spirit that's capable of more cruelty or more sadism than a human is.
Yeah, we kind of don't even really need actual demons to possess us. If we got a real demon into into one of our labs, we'd probably do more horrible things to it than it could have to us.
I absolutely believe that, and I think people lose sight when they read fiction. I know you're a fan of Lovecraft, and so am I. But when you think of all the horrible things that are going to happen to humanity, well, all that stuff sprang from human imagination. I mean, it wasn't like the human brain was innocent of these thoughts until it got the message from some kind of demonic, information source. I mean, this came out of the human mind, and anything a human being has thought of, somebody has done. I think that's one thing that worries me about. Some of your modern horror movies that really focus on the violence, like the Saw movies and the Hostel. It's I understand it's entertainment, but the level that people enjoy it as entertainment, it bothers me just because it's not as real as it's not as fictional as people want to pretend it is. All you got to do is go to some narco terror blogs about what's going on in Mexico, or keep up with how ISIS or any country that has humans in it has done over time, to realize that that's not actually fiction. It's just fictionalized in a form that people want us to enjoy for some reason.
That's might be a good description or articulation of why I'm not really into it. Like, sometimes people are surprised after they find out the kind of stuff I'm into to find out that I don't really watch what are billed as horror movies. Like, these kinds of, the hack and slash type of, just violence, gore, or even like the bizarre kind of grotesque, like human centipede stuff. I don't watch them, and I'm not into them, and I don't really enjoy it. For one, it's that deep mythological is missing there. And two, it's like, it's not so clearly fiction. Like, you make the wrong people mad in the wrong part of Mexico, and could happen to you, by the end of the week.
I liked what you said about it. The mythological connection is missing. There is not a greater story behind it. It is pornography, and which is neither good or bad. But people have to understand it for what it is. It's just a sensual enjoyment for whatever the part of their brain that needs that. But it is pornography and not something that has an artistic bent behind us. Like, is there a lesson behind this violence? And some people can pull that off very well. They can be very graphically violent, but there is something behind it. Like, there's one film I'm thinking of in particular that escapes. Antichrist, I believe, was it, which was very violent and disturbing. But it served an artistic purpose. There was a message behind it. And as far as people doing, when you think of, say, the human centipede, that makes me think of Nazi experiments during World War II, the Japanese experiments on POWs, and what they did to the Chinese during the war. There's no shortage of examples. If somebody wants to hold up a movie, I'll show you an example of where that's been done. You only have to see one family sit through a court case where evidence has been presented or photographs of how their daughter was murdered to see that this stuff has an actual impact. And it's really hard for me to take that as entertainment.
How do you deal with that, if you don't mind my asking? I'm just going to ask you all these things asking. How do you deal with seeing those kinds of things, and then not only like seeing the photographs, but sometimes like being on the scene when it's still there being photographed, or dealing with having to arrest the people who did these horrible things to other people, and then you have to go home at night and watch a Netflix show and eat some ice cream? Like, how in the world can you move from one world to
another? Fortunately,
my
job has all been, just been basically dealing with court stuff or as they come in the in corrections and housing them. Road work, that's never been anything I've had to do. I've known people that have been involved in things like investigating the sexual crimes against children, and they end up going to therapy. That's because they're good at it and they do it too long, and they don't have a great way of dealing with it, and you need to keep people in jobs like that in there for a very limited amount of time. Most of my stuff has been, secondhand in most ways, or basically living with the person that committed the crime for a long period of time. When people on the road arrest them, they're with the people for a few hours, maybe longer if they're interviewing them. But we end up living with them.
You spend more time
with them than you do your actual family. So in one way that kind of humanizes most of them, because you see everybody in their weaknesses, and just that a lot of people just made really poor decisions and were dealing with mental health issues or addiction issues, and doesn't free them of responsibilities of their actions. Everybody has to take responsibility for those. But when you ask about true evil, there are not a lot of people that I would ever put in that category. There are a couple. There was one man who'd killed a family, did things to them before he killed them, and then burned the house down, and he was sentenced to death and finally executed. And you didn't have to be around him very long to at least know that he lacked any empathy, any emotional connection to people, and he was one of these people. It was just what he wanted. Is that evil? It might be. The cruelty, I think, that he did was evil. There are other people that, I think they crossed that line. But I don't know that people are ever truly. Most people aren't ever truly one or the other. I think we can all cross that line and do things that would be construed as evil without summing up their whole life as being evil. But I start to believe that if people are influenced by anything supernatural, it's usually when they're at their weakest. If somebody has really poor mental health, if somebody is dealing with like addiction and they're just really down in a dark hole. I don't think there's many things that something supernatural could influence a human to do that they wouldn't already do anyway. It's like what they say about if you're drinking, you're just doing or saying what you really think or would do anyway. You just lack the inhibition. So maybe there's something out there that just kind of is just kind of flicking you on the ear a little bit and said, go on and do it when you're at your weakest. But, in the end, people still have to own those decisions. But I do think there is something that is other, something that is I don't know. I believe that there's a lot of really positive energy, positive forces, positive spirits, but I also believe in balance. So every time I feel like I've had something on my side just really watching out for me, which I feel like has happened a lot, I've been very blessed in a lot of ways. If there's going to be balance in the cosmos, then there's got to be something that's out there that's kind of negative. Maybe not actually working against me, but there's got to be a balanced force for whatever that we witness that's actually good.
Yeah, and kind of relating to that John Michael Greer episode, you're the one who gave me his book on monsters that has this wonderful pragmatic section in the back about, how do you deal with a place that you feel has this kind of otherness that's dark and malevolent, this kind of evil, or if you feel like you've been targeted by dark magic, and he has these recipe instructions for an amulet.
Yes.
And Melissa made one and we sent it to you. Among other things, I think we sent you old iron horseshoes,
holy water.
And holy water.
That's all kept together like in one kind of kit. Usually kept one place where I can actually get to it easily. I've taken that amulet with me on quite a few times to different places. Sometimes to work. I told you before not too long ago about a friend's house that it felt like somebody in her, this person who had been in her house for a while, I think had some mental health issues and also probably had I have nothing to back this up, but going just by intuition, and I'm a big believer in your gut feeling. It may not be right, but if your gut is telling you that something is wrong, you got to listen to it. You may not know what it is that's wrong, but you always need to listen. But if anything was going on with this guy and had some kind of negative energy just kind of clinging to him, you know, and I felt like when he left, it was there something there that he left behind, or was there something in the house that had been clinging to him? But there was just something not right, and there was a lot of negative feelings about the house and things going on in the house. And so, yeah, I went to that book had been so useful with before, like just how to break up negative energy, especially with the use of steel or iron in a ritualistic kind of shape. And that's why when I knew what your book was going to be, I couldn't wait to send that to you, not knowing that you already knew Mr. Greer and was a huge fan. But yeah, that amulet. Whenever I feel like something weird that I can't explain is going on, or something that is – when you're dealing with something that you don't understand, I don't understand pretty much anything. I mean, whether it's real life or whether it's something that's afterlife, I don't pretend to know what I'm doing most of the time. But if it's this place that you just feel like it's going to be wrong, I take that with me, because it's just – Mr. Greer knows more than I would ever pretend to be able to try to learn. So, hey, you know, why not try his advice on other things? And so when you made that amulet, I thought that was very touching, and I was very appreciative of it. And yeah, that stays with me whenever I feel like something weird or a little scary or whatever is going on.
Yeah, and that's so cool to know that it's still in use. It's still seeing field work. Cause I thought, man, we should make one of these. But like, I don't know. The darkest place I go to is like Walmart on a Saturday. Like, hey, it's awful.
Well, you know what? Don't underestimate the darkness of Walmart. I mean, if anybody from Walmart's listening, don't kill me. And because Walmart's where people are, you know, and people can bring their stuff with them.
That's true.
No, you just never know when you're going to encounter it. I think the places that I've been that have felt odd are places that were the last place I ever expected to feel that something was frightening. You know, there may not be a history behind it, but it doesn't mean that these energies don't move around, or that if there is some kind of being that we can't see. I mean, nothing says they have to stay in one place. We're not necessarily dealing all the time with just like psychic snapshots of a haunted house, or however people wanted to describe that phenomena that they've experienced. And I know you did talk about the haggings. And my grandmother was, you know, my grandmother was, I would almost say plagued at some point with premonitions when she was, and my grandmother was always, she's very pragmatic. She was not a person that was imaginative in a way to like storytelling. You know, she was very smart, but she was very practical and not somebody that would just, tell stories to entertain children. That was just never her bent. So whenever I would hear about the premonitions or experiences she had when she was a child of people dreaming people died, and they actually died either before, you know, had already died and they hadn't gotten word, or they died soon after, or had the apparitions appear.
Wow. And she would have the dream? She'd had the dream of it before it happened, or before?
Yes, there have been the case where she dreamed that it would happen, and it did happen. And there was one time when she saw her aunt walking up to their house. They lived in a rural part of West Virginia, on the backside of a place called Drew Mountain, which is actually one of the most haunted spots in West Virginia. Most people think it's the Civil War battle there, but I think it's just that whole area is just riddled with the supernatural. And she saw her aunt walking up the road to their home place, and she ran back up to tell her mom that her aunt was coming, and they came back out the way. Well, she never showed up, and she remembered exactly what she was wearing, which was a big blue sweater with a wide belt and silver buttons on the sweater. And I was too young to delve more deeply like I would now, because I really want to know what they were thinking when she didn't show up. Did she just think she was seeing something? And I know she told me at one point, but I was young and can't quite remember. But it was – I think it was that next day they had gotten a telegram, because her aunt didn't live close by. That's why it was such a surprise that she saw her. They got a telegram that she had died. And I don't remember if it was that same day, if it was before that. And then there was a package that was sent to their address that was forwarded on to them that had been ordered by their aunt. And it was that exact same sweater. And between that and again, she's just not she's not she was not imaginative enough to again just generate stories. And there were other things that had happened and but with all that explained a lot of anxiety I think she had later in life. If somebody was just traveling or out on the road, she constantly worried. Constantly worried that something was going to happen to somebody.
Yeah, and that reminds me of a few different stories as well. Like Melissa is as imaginative enough to make that kind of stuff up if she wanted to, but there's been many times when she's just been hit by this intuition that I'm completely oblivious of, but now I'm smart enough to know anytime she has any type of intuition, listen to her and just move, whatever it is. And it turns out that her grandmother, through her mother's side, again, sounds like yours, like she was extremely pragmatic, no nonsense, didn't want any fooling with any of that silliness. But there were several stories where she would be where she would be, say, taking a nap on the couch in the afternoon and then wake up from a nightmare of just fire, visions of fire, and wake up screaming and then freaking out about where the kids are, and come to find out the kids got caught in this
Wow.
strange field fire like 2 miles away simultaneously. And so these kinds of intuitions, I think, pop up in everybody. And I feel like at some point I'm so dull-minded, like I can't even catch on to real intuitions. Like if there's like I set down a glass of water in my periphery and I'll just turn around and knock it over, and I'm even the one who set it there, and I can't see that coming. And so
Well,
but
if I had a penny for every time I did something like that, or can't find the pencil I stuck behind my ear.
But I mean, I remember distinctly this one time. I was just a teenager, and one of my friends worked at the theater, and so I could just get in and watch movies whenever I felt like for free, while he was on the shift, and we would hang out in between them, and sometimes he would sit in there and watch them too. And so I was just in there by myself in this thing. God, I normally am not caught up with coughing like this during any episodes too. I wonder what's going on.
Well, when you started coughing before, I started thinking, evil, evil throat tickling.
Oh yeah, maybe that's what it is. And I'm in the middle of this theater, and there's, I don't know, it's semi, maybe a third of the theater is full or something like that. It's not too much, and it was some silly movie. It was Night at the Roxbury, that movie off of that Saturday Night Live thing with Will Ferrell. And it was just in the middle watching this silly movie, and I'm laughing, and it's stupid and it's funny. Not a care in the world, just some teenager with a free Coke and a free movie on some evening watching a silly movie. And then all of a sudden, the hairs on the back of my neck stand up, and I am just overcome with, like, my blood runs cold, and something in my head is screaming, "Get out, get out, get out." And I just bolt out of there. I don't even say anything to my friend. I call him later. I jump in the van and I just drive straight home, and my eyes are peeled and I'm full of adrenaline. I have no idea why. And the story would be so much cooler if it turned out like there was a wreck on the highway right after the movie or something that I avoided. Nothing that I know of ever happened, and it was the weirdest feeling. And I had a few of those as a kid too, and some odd stories of my parents finding me talking to something that wasn't there when I'm just a little toddler in a house that they thought was haunted and stuff too. But if I had any of that, I have completely lost it now, because I can't, like I said, I can't even catch a glimpse of my water sneaking up on me into my rugs.
Well, I think some people believe that children are much more perceptive because they're much closer to that spiritual place that they come from as young, and as they grow older, they grow more accustomed to our mortal senses and more detached from the experience they had prior to not just being pure spirit. I mean, I think that's one thing that people believe. So it makes sense that if you're attuned to certain things, you lose it as you get older. And some people, I think, managed to maintain it, whatever it is. I won't presume to know what it is. But the thing is, you know, you're leaving that theater, and people have people need to trust their guts. Whether we're talking about just being in a crowded place and you feel like something's wrong, you feel like something's dangerous, you don't need to know what it is. You don't need to know why you feel that way. It's just important that you start paying attention to everything that's going on around you. And if leaving is the most prudent thing for you to do, then you just do it. There's all kinds of people that ignored a gut feeling or a sixth sense or whatever you want to call it that wish they hadn't.
Yeah.
And there's plenty of people that paid attention to it, and it was obvious why it was good that they did. But the thing about, like, when you acted on that, the thing is you don't know what would have happened if you hadn't. And it may not have been like there's something bad happened in the theater, because clearly nothing did happen bad in the theater. Who knows what could have happened on the road if you left at the normal time?
Yeah.
You know, who knows? And that's from a supernatural perspective. You know, if it's a spiritual warning, you know, trying to make sure that you're not in danger, there's that. But we're all, you know, we're still – when we're not too preoccupied with our – regular five senses, and especially now in the days of electronics and constantly staring at our phones and stuff, where we're just preoccupied with everything around us, animals are able to they have odd senses, and human beings had to have them, you know, just from surviving as a primate. You know, and that stuff's still in there. It's not like it's a modern anomaly that's popping up. It's actually really, I think, most likely a biological degradation that it dies out as we just become more and more safe.
Yeah, and even like some of the modern research on this kind of stuff. Now, the kind of stuff that Johns Hopkins is doing over there with psilocybin, I think, is really opening up what's possible to admit about consciousness. Now,
yes.
I think we're just now tapping into that. Man, I wish I would have asked Greer about that too. But anyway, but even just as something as simple as they're doing some research recently on just trying to detect whether or not someone is lying. And they would, and it was as far as I know, it was a perfectly valid experiment with a control and everything. And they had, and a double blind, I think, as much as they could have. And they had groups of people who were trained in professional lie detection, say techniques, and others who had just learned a little bit about it, and others who knew nothing. And they brought in different people telling them lies and telling them truths. And they all, it was simple. It was one of those things. Would you trust the person, or are they lying? Are they not? Do you trust them or do you not? And nobody could do better than 50-50, since it was a 50-50 kind of thing. Are they lying or not? Nobody could do better. Even the experts weren't doing any better. And a lot of the people did worse than 50-50. And then they would go back to them, say, like, I don't know, 5 hours later or something, a long time afterward. And they were like, you know, person A, do you feel like that person's trustworthy, or would you trust that? And they were like, no, I wouldn't really trust that person to, like, with my car keys or something like that. So they would ask more of these, like, gut feelings much later, those kinds of questions. Mm-hmm. And their success rate for picking out the liars skyrocketed to something like 70-80%. And it was shutting down that rational brain and going back to that intuition or that gut feeling was immensely more accurate than trying to figure out whether someone was lying.
I think that makes perfect sense to me. Perfect sense. And also, I think there's this part of people, especially like polite people, that are a little loath to call somebody just a flat out liar.
Yeah.
You know, if you ask me, is this person lying? It's like, oh, I don't want to call him a liar, because you just don't know. A lot of people just doubt because they don't have enough information to base that decision on. So they don't want to necessarily just call somebody a liar, because that's a pretty hefty label.
Yeah.
But when you can give them the option of saying, how much do you just trust them? I think it gives them a little bit more liberty to maybe not be so polite, but that makes perfect sense, though, that when they don't analyze like whether they think they're telling the truth or not, just what they think of them as a person. That's great data, and it's really interesting. And I think I would have, if you just asked me if that was what the outcome would be, I would have had to say yes, without even thinking about it, because people read people better than they realize. It's just our level of being polite tends to cover up us wanting to be mean. Like one of the issues with when you have a predator, let's say approaching a woman on the street, usually it's just like they're overly polite or they're very polite, and they put people in the position of not wanting to be rude. Yeah. They don't want them, I don't want to tell this guy to get the F away from me because I don't know why, you're just making me uncomfortable, get away. Well, a lot of people won't do that because it's not really polite, and I think that's something that people are trying to have to train themselves into doing that. It's okay to be not polite. You know, somebody can recover from hurt feelings if you're wrong, but you can't recover from what could happen to you if they mean you ill will, or it may take a long time to recover from whatever happens. But that's a really interesting about that. And what you said about the psilocybin, that's also fascinating to me in the realm of consciousness expansion and, you know, how science is kind of – they explored it a little bit, and then they kind of – well, it's drugs. We're just going to shut that research off, at least not make it as popular, but now getting back into it. When dealing with some people that have been mentally ill and also high, but mostly people that are mentally ill and they're going through a certain kind of mania, I've heard them talk and say a lot of things, and other people listen to them, they're just being crazy. And as I listen to them, it's like actually, you know, what they're describing is so close to a mystical experience. Now, some of it's a nightmare. Some of it is a waking nightmare. But other things that they say is absolutely mirroring what a person that was not mentally ill or not under the influence of something, they would describe a mystical experience in the exact same way. So
what kinds of stuff would they describe or say?
Oh, the feeling of oneness, of kind of like a universal love or connection with absolutely everything, which is, you know, like with LSD, it's able to trigger that pretty well, or things like ecstasy, you know, I don't know the chemistry of ecstasy enough about the effects of it to initially class that into that, but things that you only ever get with things that deliberately expand your consciousness or mysticism. And so I think there's a part of the brain that the hallucinogens are showing to be having some success to open up to, that I think people that have mystical experiences can tap into, and people that have certain things in mental illness also have more access to parts of the brain that experience that. I don't know really how it all ties together. I mean, even close to how it ties together, but it's just an observation that I've had. But of course, that makes since the good experiences can be, you know, very positive and very profound, then the negative experiences, they're going to have the opposite of, they're going to have that much weight in the opposite. People that really are delusional and having terrifying delusions, it's what's really heartbreaking, because it's, you know, that, I mean, that's really, I mean, is what they see, it's what they experience.
Man, that's fascinating. And it sounds like the chemistry of it, at least with psilocybin and a lot of the hallucinogens, is not what the kind of stereotype kind of pseudoscience belief is, that it like triggers or activates unused parts of the brain. If anything, it's opposite. It shuts down a lot of the day-to-day kind of ego rationalistic parts of the brain. Those shut up, and the older kind of alligator brain parts start firing, and taking over. And so you get something closer to like uncurated or unedited reality, or instinct as well, or impulse as well. But the the prospect of a dark trip or a trip into hell, I think, is what's going to keep me from ever trying psilocybin. If anybody wants to know, does the monster professor do it? No, he's terrified of everything. I am definitely not going to like take a red pill to hell. Oh my God.
Well, you see, and that, but I think a lot of that is also what you bring with you. I mean, I don't have any personal experience with hallucinogens, but I know people that have had like bad experiences. But that's like saying, like, would Josh ever have a frightening mystical experience? I'd have to say flat out no. I mean, it's kind of like, well, the notion of hell. I'm going to say, like, Ted Bundy is burning in hell. What is that? So I certainly don't know what hell is. I think that there's enough – I think I feel certain enough to say that people can experience hell before they ever leave this planet. People are going to experience heaven before they leave this planet. And it would be hard for any kind of supernatural – supervisor, being the devil or whatever, to come up with something worse than what some people have to live through every day, except to make it last forever. I think that maybe that's what hell is. You know, it's the never ending worst thing that somebody could torture themselves with. But it's like somebody like you, you don't bring that with you. You know, and when you asked earlier about what I do to have done for to deal with things that I saw, I didn't always really know what to do with it. You know, that's when you kind of you kind of channel some energy into writing or photography, or sometimes you just feel really bad for a while. But I think what started changing for me is when I could look at somebody and realize that is basically me in another form.
Yeah.
You know, the seeds to do all these things that people do that are horrible, they're in all of us, and it's an uncomfortable thought to know that that's something that's in you, but it's also kind of comforting in another way, in that it's like, in that you know what it is now. You know, this is just humanity, and the way you offset it is you become more human in the other direction. You know, some people, their bent is on destruction, so you counteract that. You create the balance by doing something more healing or more constructive, whether it's art or reaching out to another human or just trying to make somebody's life a little bit better for a little while.
Yeah, and you're kind of hitting on a theme that seems to be one of the few running themes on this podcast throughout all the episodes, is that this kind of, like, one reason why monsters are so important to us in stories and films and folklore is that, you know, just about every darn person who loves a monster story, even without being told of this interpretation, ends up coming up with this idea that, man, the monster is me, or the monster is I, and I am the monster, or that this monster is just another picture of what's possible in us and inside of us.
Yeah, absolutely. Even on a more practical level of personal development, the dragon's always inside of us. Very rarely is the dragon outside. I mean, we have bad experiences that happen, but the real challenge is, how do we deal with them? That's not to negate somebody's horrific trauma, but things like that you can't control, the next challenge is, well, how do you deal with that, and how do you heal from it, or things that you experience other people go through. I think when – and you had one podcast as well, how do you kill it? How do you fight the monster? Well, if the monster is in people, it's like you fight it not necessarily by fighting the person, because that's you're fighting human nature, and you can't change human nature, but you can counterbalance it. And so you kill the monster by killing something with kindness. I think it's not as cliche as I used to think it was. Killing somebody with kindness, in the old way I used to take it, by meaning, say, well, if somebody's being mean to you, just be nice to them, and you'll get your reward in heaven, or whatever it was. Or some people just can't stand it if you're nice to them and they're mean to you. That's kind of how I took it when I was a kid. I think you really do kill monsters with kindness now by creating a different world. You know, a world where You can't change what your horrible neighbor across the street did to somebody else, but you can make somebody else's life better. So yeah, you offset the monstrous behavior in humanity with positive aspects of humanity that only you have control of. And we can't control what the government does. We can't control what people. We can't control what this person next to us does, but we can control what we do, and that doing a kindness. And sometimes you have to be unkind to stop. You know, if violence is going on, you have to do violence to stop it. I'm not by no means a pacifist, but I think ultimately you kill other monsters, the effects of the monsters, by doing the opposite.
Yeah, between recognizing that whatever that dragon is on out there, or whatever that evil monster of a person over there is doing, is actually just, you know, within one bad day or one bad decision, one step away from what I could quickly be, or perhaps already am, that kind of thing. And then how do you do that? That offsetting with positivity. Those mm-hmm. those are perhaps the most profound possible answers to how do you kill it? Because that was on my list next. So let's get to how do you kill it. And I think I don't know if that can ever be topped by any of these episodes.
The monsters. I mean, the mythology and monster stories. I mean, once you realize what the monster actually is, and then what we're killing is that part of ourselves, and that's what everybody, I think, in a different way is saying. You know, it's just it's just through mythological ways.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think that's if nothing else, perhaps one of Jung's great contributions to the modern era, way to bring in some of the ancient stuff, is what if you saw all of this happening inside your own head and everyone else's, then what can be gleaned from it? And then whole worlds open up, I think, mm-hmm. of what those ancient stories were, and maybe why they were more important than we quite realize.
Yes. Oh, absolutely. And Jung was instrumental in me helping me to kind of realize this about myself, especially coming from a purely I grew up Presbyterian. You can never say Presbyterians are hardcore, but when I was a youth, you know, I grew up Presbyterian, and I was very devout then. And so I saw the nature of redemption kind of in one light. And it would never the idea of redeeming myself or understanding myself by accepting my capacity for evil and understanding the depths of what that is would never have occurred to me then until I became familiar with Jung and some other writers. Then I really began to understand. It's like, yeah, this is part of all of us. And if you want to know one thing, you've got to kind of at least understand your capacity for the other. And I think that's what's – when we go back to killing monsters and with acts of kindness, I think people have to apply that to themselves, because you may be a monster for a moment. But this is where the notion of redemption comes in. Whether you believe it is redemption through a Christ or a personal kind of redemption, but the whole notion of redemption is that this is not that day. You know, your worst day is not this day. And by doing something different and doing something better, that redemption, I can't stop the bad things that I did, and I've done plenty that I'm ashamed of. I can't go back and change time, but I can be better than what I was. And that's fighting that monster.
Yeah. Well, man, you've been extremely generous with your time, because not only did I push you way past, say, a 40-ish minute line here, but if you add in all of our internet attacks from the dark forces that kept shutting off, I've had you on here for a very long time. So do you mind if I just hit you with one simple but extremely difficult question as a finisher?
As you can ask me as many questions as you want. I didn't even realize that much time had gone by. But sure, yeah. Have at it.
All right. The simplest and the toughest question of all, who is your favorite monster, or what is your favorite monster of all time?
Oh, okay.
And why, of course.
Oh, wow. Okay, let's see. You know, I don't even know. This is embarrassing to be on the Monster Professor, and you know, I don't even know that I have an answer. Let's see.
But if someone's putting you on the spot like I am, and you had to name
okay.
just one.
Well, mine's going to be pretty simple. Mine's going to be pretty simple. And I think it is the Wolfman or werewolf, any lycanthrope.
Yeah.
Because right that there, that's the duality. That's the duality.
Yeah, the human with the beast inside that you can turn mm-hmm. at any moment. The good with the evil inside that's out of your control.
Yeah. I feel a little plebeian by not having a more sophisticated answer. Because it's a universal monster to me.
And using the word plebeian correctly, as you just did, kind of clears you of that charge. the werewolf is a deeply fundamental, it's an image and so much so that I think that like the wolf or the werewolf itself is one of the few kind of archetypical categories of monster, at least as it is. And I shouldn't talk about this book, this nonfiction book I'm working on. Until it's done. But anyway, I kind of let loose a little bit in my chapter on the archetypes of monsters. I think that has to be one of them. So it's something deeply familiar, but it's not like it's because there was one fascinating book written about it. Like it wasn't Mary Shelley's Wolfman or Bram Stoker's Wolfman that got everybody knowing exactly what a werewolf is. Instead, mm-hmm. somehow we just all kind of know what that thing is.
Oh yeah. I mean, because it's very, I mean, it's so common in, I guess I could say folk legend, maybe not folklore. I don't know. There may not be a difference between the two, but, through so many different countries, there is a theme of people becoming, you know, another type of animal. Sometimes it's kind of benevolent. Sometimes it's just pure animal. Sometimes it's evil or wicked and you know, tears people apart. But it's something that happens really across culture. And I remember one particular story, not in great detail, about one that was in France. Middle Ages, and that was, it struck me as particularly horrifying that you just kept tearing people apart. And again, I can't remember the details. It's been so long since I read it.
It was like in the 1600s
yes.
is the one I'm thinking of.
Yeah.
The Gouraud or something like that,
yes.
like the wolf of.
That's yeah, it. That is at it exactly.
Yeah, and it was really tearing people apart, so much so that I think it's still on the books somewhere in France that it's illegal to be a lycanthrope within city limits or something like that.
Well, you know, ever since now we get into this and why, my favorite monsters, now that I think of it, when I was a kid, that's what I was afraid of.
Yeah.
I mean, I remember walking to my home when I was a kid, and it'd be dark, and lived in the woods, so wherever I'd be walking from was dark in our woods, and sometimes it didn't have a flashlight, and it was always a wolf or wolf type creature that was worried about seeing me, you know, from the, you know, out in the trees.
Yeah.
You know, and then when you're little, if you just had a flashlight, you had that little halo of safety, you know, but you didn't want to shine it into the trees.
Look scarier.
Yeah. But you didn't want to shine it into the trees because you really didn't want to see it.
Yeah. Yeah.
You're pretty sure it's there. You definitely don't want to see it because if you see it, then you know it's got to kill you.
Yeah. It's true.
But yeah. Now that I think about it, it was the werewolves that always scared me. And I remember when I first saw American Werewolf in London, transformation. That was one of the best transformations I'd ever seen up to that point. And that was a little nightmarish.
It still is. It holds up. It's horrifying.
It really does. I mean, you know, CGI has come a long way, but in some ways it's kind of killed imagination because some things can look too real now.
Yeah.
That was one of those things that was just enough. It was just real enough. This like that it seemed realistic, but your imagination could also run with it. I don't know if that makes any sense, but anyway, somebody
yeah.
CGI has killed some of the horror for me in some ways.
Yeah, I think that transformation scene, what it did for me is it just showed like you know, it suggested the bones lengthening just enough, and like the, and then the muscles like tearing just enough to get me starting to take seriously, oh my God, what would it actually be like if your body just went through this metamorphosis in like 2 minutes? It would be the most painful experience you could ever possibly imagine. And then that's what I'm seeing on the screen. It's horrifying.
Yep. Yeah.
Well, thank you so much, man. This has been a fantastic conversation, and you've been extremely generous with as deep as you are willing to go with some of these rather dark and personal questions, I think, and as well as with your time. It's been a huge pleasure.
Oh, the pleasure is all mine. It's always great talking to you. What rare times we do talk voice to voice or face to face. It's definitely my pleasure to talk to you and to discuss some of these things with you, because I know that you take all this stuff very seriously, but in a way that is just pure. It is part of your passion, and it's great to see somebody just pursuing their passion and having such a great time doing it.
Yeah, and what I end up calling this podcast really is just an excuse to get to talk with people I want to talk with. and you're somebody that, you know, we could have Skyped and just talked about these kinds of things for the longest time, and we just didn't. And now here's an excuse to make us actually do it. And so I'm really glad we did.
Well, then I guess we're just going to have to Skype more often and just have conversations then.
Yeah, that sounds great. I'm in. Well, thanks again, man.
You're very welcome. Thank you.